we are getting changes in the definition of what constitutes rape. I'd like to touch also on how scholars classified rape in Islamic law, the kind of witness and evidence that was required to prove rape, the issue of what some would call marital rape, does that actually exist? The question of pregnancy in the case of rape on the question of abortion, and then looking at issues to do with prevention and how to handle this problem as a community. Firstly, in the discussion, I will be focusing primarily on the Sunni school. So I would not be looking at how do the Ja'fari madhab, the Shia or the Ibadis or the Mu'tazila scholars look at the subject area. I'm really more interested in the Maliki in particular, but also, and that's just because of where we are, but also the Hanafi, Shafi, Hanbali school and the Zahiri school, especially the interesting opinions of Ibn Hazm. Firstly, the subject of rape, the challenge comes from the very beginning to do with the definition. What are we talking about? For some, and in many countries until now, rape is simply a man having forced sexual intercourse with a woman against her will. So it's coercive.
Alhamdulillah, we are unable to hear some of the voice because of the participants. Can you please mute some of the participants?
I would suggest the admin mute everybody except the speaker. It's important, please.
Okay, I would mute everyone, and the speaker should mute himself immediately.
All right. Thank you very much. And so when we look at our context, it is very important to recognize, of course, as we know, rape is nothing new to human society. It's a terrible crime that has existed in many societies. It is the most unreported violent crime. And we will come back to this problem of the unreported nature of rape and why that's a big problem when it comes to the kind of evidence required to prove rape cases. But very briefly, the concept of rape, as most societies today would like to look at it, would be one that recognizes a man raping a woman, which is the usual form of rape, but also recognizes a man being raped by a woman, or a woman being raped by another woman, or a man raping another woman. But also to not just look at it as a sexual thing between the private part of the man and that of the woman, but insertion of anything into the woman. So whether it is with the hand, whether it is with an instrument, whether it is with the sexual organ, and whether it is the vagina or whether it is the anus. It is this breaking into somebody's private territory, somebody's private part, forcibly, and we will come back to this question of coercion and what constitutes that, that we are talking about. And so some have felt more comfortable because the word rape has usually just been a man raping a woman. They have felt more comfortable with a term like sexual assault, other terms to accommodate the various forms of rape involved. The problem, of course, with this, and this topic is not a topic that you speak of in isolation of all the other wrongs in society. So by touching on this topic at a time when in Nigeria, this is becoming a very sensitive issue because of some of the very highlighted cases we have seen on the news recently. Globally, according to the UN, there are about 250,000 cases of rape reported. Having said that, various statistics show that only 5, in some places up to 30%, of the cases of rape are even reported. And in Nigeria, the studies seem to show only about 5% of cases are reported. So whatever cases we get really constitutes just 1 out of 20 cases. So you'd have to multiply that by 19 to have an idea of how prevalent this problem is. The problem of rape is one which is a major mafsada. It's a major harm. One of the objectives of Sharia, or what is called the maqasid of Sharia, is the promotion of good, jalbul masaleh wa dar'ul mafasid, and the prevention and the prohibition of harm. So it's really about enjoining what is right and forbidding what is wrong. The problem with rape is it undermines many of the maqasid of Sharia. It is not just an assault on the dignity of the person, and the person is made to feel ashamed, embarrassed, and humiliated. It is also an assault on the mind of the person, because this individual usually has to live with psychological scars, traumas, and the traumas are often more painful than some physical injury. A person would rather you cut their hand or finger or slash them somewhere. They can more easily live with that kind of wound than to live with the wound of rape and what they went through. So it affects the mind, it affects the family. The person who has been raped usually finds it difficult to continue living normal life as if nothing happened. And the big problem with this is because a lot of rape is domestic. A lot of the abuse of children, in the case of what they call statutory rape, where somebody who is below the age of consent has been sexually assaulted by somebody who is much older, this type, the most common place where this happens is not on the street or somewhere. Unfortunately, it is at the home. It is among relatives, it is stepfathers, it is various forms of incest taking place. I think we're having more noise in the background. Forgive me for cutting what I'm saying.
I'm listening to a conference on rape. It's a webinar on rape. And it's a man that is anchoring. Go to my WhatsApp status.
Mute your phone, we can hear you.
Sorry.
Mohammed,
I smile. Assalamu alaikum, moderator. Assalamu alaikum, brother Abdul Rashid. Mute everyone except the speaker. You have the control. Everyone coming in should be completely mute. Except the speaker, please.
Excuse me, let him check the setting as well. He can do that from the setting.
The video is also disruptive, please. Can we turn off people's videos as well, please?
I strongly suggest that the admin should mute everyone, unless the speaker, please.
Absolutely, he can do that from the settings.
And I would like to recommend, if you don't mind, and maybe the moderator can emphasize that, if you have comments, whether you agree or disagree, there's the chat, inshallah, there that we can look at. So questions, inshallah, are not forgotten, inshallah, as we go on. So with your permission, I will proceed, inshallah. So the assault of rape is undermining the maqasid of ird, human dignity, the akal, the intellect, and its proper functioning, the family, and especially the fact that a lot of it is also domestic. Most rape, over 70 to 80% of rape cases are by people known to the victim. and we will come back to this. Unfortunately, the trauma that people go through, and sometimes the irresponsiveness and irresponsibility of the loved ones when it comes to the victim of rape, sometimes the fact that the rape is actually perpetrated by someone who is a religious figure and respected within the community as a teacher, as a preacher, as an imam, or an Islamia teacher, unfortunately that shakes the faith of the victim, and they actually start getting angry with the whole religion and the religious establishment. It undermines the future of these people. We know how haram something like zina is in Islam. After shirk and murder, one of the greatest offenses is zina, extramarital relations. But this is where somebody is forcing themselves. It's even worse than zina. It's worse than highway robbery, in that many people would rather you rob them of their property than you rob them of their chastity, than you rape them or rob them of their virginity. And this is partly why, as we will see later, some scholars feel that the problem of zina, sorry, of rape, should not be categorized under zina, but under hiraba, violent crime, which we will look at very shortly. So key thing to take away, number one, it is a very horrible crime. Number two, it is very, very unreported. In other words, if you get one case of zina, of rape proven, they actually find that over 50% of rapists are not first-time offenders. So when you actually catch somebody doing rape, that is not the first time they started. Many of these cases are actually repeated again and again. And it is only when a case is being brought out that others feel more comfortable to speak, that you realize this person has been a serial abuser of his relationships with others. And so just like our problem with COVID-19, rape is actually a pandemic. It's a problem that affects societies all over the world, but it's also very asymptomatic, just like COVID, that the people who have it don't show signs, they don't show symptoms, and sometimes only they know the traumas that they are going through. And because it is difficult to prove, because it is done in various circumstances, as we will see, many have had problems coming forward. So this is an area that requires greater sensitivity of those who care, who want to deal with it, whether the victim is known to you or not. But this group of people who are victims require far more rahmah, far more compassion from the society of scholars, of organizations, of the legal structure than we have seen. God forbid it happens close to you or to yourself in order for us to wake up to the terror that is involved in this kind of crime. From the point of view of Muslim jurists, the offenses and the punishments of Sharia are generally classified into three broad groups. You have those offenses that are called qisas, or what you call equitable retribution, where it's an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, but usually it's a form of equitable compensation. So if you kill somebody, yes, you may be killed, but more often there's another compensation that is given if it is not forgiven, unless it is murder or a case where the state is actually concerned and ensures that the person is punished. So you've got one category of punishment that deal with injuries and torts and that type of thing under qisas. The other category of punishments are called the hudud. The hudud are prescribed punishments in Islamic law where the judge has very little maneuverability once the case has been proven beyond a shadow of doubt or beyond all reasonable doubt. The punishment is very clear. Very often, the kind of evidence required is also quite clear what is required for certain cases like zina or extramarital relations. Under the category of hudud, you have another group called hiraba. And this is based on Quran chapter 5, verse 33. And these are a couple of prescribed punishments for this offense of hiraba, what the Quran describes as waging war against Allah and His Messenger and causing fasad and fitna and destruction or corruption in the land. And this category, which we will look at a bit more closely, covers various forms of offenses, including treason, including terrorism, including brigandage, highway robbery or armed robbery, including assassination, including war crimes where innocent civilians have been killed by soldiers. So you have a lot of those type of things. And under that category, some scholars, and we will look at this, put offenses like gang rape and rape itself under the crime of hiraba. Now, the crime of hiraba, the Quran gives various very severe punishments. One is it could be death sentence. Another, it could be crucifixion. Another, it could be amputation of opposite limbs, so the right hand and the left foot, for example. Or what the Quran describes as exile, which many scholars consider as similar to imprisonment. So you can have for these crimes, punishments, this crime of this category of hiraba, a choice where the judge would look at the severity of the particular offense, the kind of evidence, the circumstances, and decide whether it's going to be imprisonment, whether it's going to be amputation, whether it's going to be crucifixion or death sentence. The other category is that of ta'zir. Ta'zir are the group of punishments that's really every other offense, where it is left to the discretion of the judge. So you find most of the punishments in Islamic law actually belong to this category of ta'zir. Ta'zir would cover probably about 90% of the various crimes of offenses. So from crossing traffic light to abusing environmental laws to any crime that doesn't fall squarely into the hudud or the isas offenses are treated as discretionary or ta'zir, and it's left to the discretion of the judge to decide what's the most appropriate punishment there. Now, on the subject of rape, the difference of opinion of the scholars falls really more on how to classify it. Should it be classified under the hudud? Sorry, that is the hiraba offenses, together with war crimes and various violent crimes against people, violent taking of things from people. Should it be classified there, or should it be classified as similar to zina, extramarital sexual relations, since it usually involved the sexual organs? So most scholars have, and I would say for the contemporary purpose, most scholars have put it under zina, but what we find in contemporary society, more and more scholars putting it under hiraba. So you have some of the very old classical scholars, such as Ibn al-Arabi, a Maliki scholar, such as Ibn Hazm, a Zahiri scholar, who look at it as belonging more to the category of hiraba, and we will look at some of their arguments. For most of the scholars, they put it under the category of zina. Now, this is by a means called qiyas. Qiyas is reasoning by analogy, by saying this is similar to that, therefore it will be treated in that category. So if you look at cocaine and consuming of narcotics or drugs, because it intoxicates, some look at it as belonging to the crime of intoxication. So it's similar to consuming alcohol. Others look at it that no, it should not belong to something like alcohol just because it intoxicates. The qiyas with alcohol is only for the purpose of confirming that it is haram, because whatever intoxicates is treated as haram. Reasoning by analogy only strengthens that argument. However, when you look at the kind of punishment for alcohol consumption that Islamic law would prescribe in some contexts, for Muslims, that is, who drink alcohol, the damage done by cocaine or drug dealers is not considered as light as the one that is from alcohol dealing or consumption. And so in many Muslim countries, they would look at dealing with drugs as requiring a punishment more severe, that in the interest of general public, or what is called maslaha, they would treat it as a crime against society, a crime against humanity, and not just you sold your drug. But the moment you are in possession of cocaine or heroin or some of these, some countries conclude you should actually get the death sentence or life imprisonment or something that would be considered more appropriate, as similar to Hiraba. So when we look at the case of rape, while for some the question of rape is treated that because sexual organs are involved, and that is of course one narrow definition of rape, but because that definition is taken by some scholars, they take it as being sufficiently similar to extramarital relations, which is zina, and would say whoever is the perpetrator. I'll just carry on. So these scholars view that whoever is the perpetrator of zina, the offense will be treated like rape. Unfortunately, what that has meant is some scholars insist, therefore, that the rape victim, in order to prove rape, must have four witnesses, which is practically impossible because most rape cases do not happen where you have four decent people who can explain what's going on. Some scholars who classify it under zina say that, yes, it is similar to zina to be treated as zina for the purpose of the punishment. However, like Ibn Qasim and Sahnoun, Maliki scholars, they take it that four witnesses are not required and one or two witnesses would be adequate. Again, the problem of that is the need for witnesses, which is usually a problem. Over 90% of cases of rape are not done where any witnesses are there to be able to see it. So 90% of these cases are done quietly where others cannot come to help, which is the nature of the offense. When we look, however, at what many have done is, when you say somebody raped me or you accuse somebody of zina, you accuse somebody of rape, because some scholars view rape as being very similar to zina, they start to ask questions of, so who are your witnesses? And if you don't have enough witnesses, then it is the punishment in Islamic law for accusing somebody of sexual intercourse outside marriage is four witnesses who can give visible testimony that they actually graphically saw, they could see the thing graphically and explain exact penetration, and that is what constitutes the evidence for zina. And if you can't produce that, then for defamation, or what is called qazaf, you are liable to 80 lashes for having defamed or claimed somebody was involved in sexual intercourse where without the prerequisite evidence. So what some do is to then say it's going to be a lesser crime. It's not, you're not accusing the person of zina. They're looking at it as a form of zina, but which will not have a punishment as severe as zina, because some scholars are of the opinion that ta'azir punishments should not be given the severity of hudud punishments. And ta'azir means discretion of the judge. So this is where the judge then gives a lesser punishment than 100 lashes that he would otherwise, or she would otherwise have given a case of zina. So these are some of the problems, but also the limitations. What compounds the problem?
The video is stopped.
Hey, but jam of
hey, go on. You can learn from Twitch.
So when the woman comes and claims she's been raped, or she comes with a pregnancy, because she didn't come with the offense earlier, some, like in some within the Maliki school, view pregnancy as being a default evidence for zina. And it is for her to prove her innocence. And we have a lot of women who have been raped, but due to shame or fear or embarrassment or threats or drugs or whatever the circumstances under which she was raped, the case was not brought. She was hoping she wouldn't get pregnant. Unfortunately, she did get pregnant. And these women are in jail in a number of Muslim countries because they cannot prove their innocence and they've got a pregnancy. The other group of scholars treat rape as belonging to the group of offenses called hiraba. Hiraba, as we've said already, is tied to violent taking of somebody else's possession or robbery, brigandage, armed robbery, all of these type of things. And when we look at the psychology of the victim, unlike zina, where in normal zina it is consensual, those involved in zina have are consenting partners and have agreed. In the case of hiraba, there's no consent. The victim is the only victim. When we look at the psychology of and the mentality of the perpetrator, the rapist is similar. He's an exploiter, both in the case of rape and in the case of hiraba. Whereas in the case of zina, the perpetrator is really consensual. It's the two of them who are happy doing what they're doing. When it comes then to the punishment, it is clear that rape is a more severe offense than zina, and therefore cannot be and should not be restricted to the same punishment as the punishment of zina. Because if we take it that punishment is usually commensurate to the gravity of the offense, then for a more serious offense, we would expect a more serious punishment. And so Ibn al-Arabi al-Maliki Qadi, a judge, when a case was brought to him of a woman who had been raped and somebody tried to belittle the offense that this woman had was a victim of, he said, the fact that the woman, however bad she felt about her possessions being taken from her, and in this case, she was just raped, the judge, Qadi Ibn al-Arabi, said, the fact that she would actually have preferred that her possession was taken than she was raped was for him enough to say that the punishment should belong to the category of hiraba, but not just that. like robbery, but a severe form of punishment under the category of hiraba, which could be imprisonment or life imprisonment, it could be death sentence, crucifixion, or amputation. So from the point of view of what is called qiyas al-awla, or from a higher kind of reasoning by analogy, if one offense like zina has a punishment, then from the point of view of a higher degree, not just robbery would have a higher punishment, but then when it is rape, it should even have a higher punishment than armed robbery would have. So these are the kind of arguments that are used by scholars, including Ibn Hazm, to say that rape should belong to the category of hiraba offenses. The other thing is, offenses of hiraba are viewed as offenses to do with the whole community. So when you have somebody who has been involved in armed robbery, and say in an armed robbery case, a car was stopped, and the armed robbers came with their cutlasses. However, somebody in the car had a gun or had guns, and they were able to apprehend the armed robbers. And they passed on these, handed over these armed robbers to the security services or the police. Those who captured the armed robbers and apprehended them do not have the right to go and say they have forgiven the offense of armed robbery. Similarly, whereas in the case of murder, the family has a say and can say that the murderer has been forgiven, in the case of assassination, where it is not that you were killed because of something you did to the assassin, this person is a hired killer, he is a threat to the state, he's a threat to security, he's not just a threat to you alone, he didn't just murder you or assassinate you because of a personal problem between the two of you. The assassin is a threat to the state, as treason is a threat to the state, as armed robbery is a threat to security on the roads. That rape is not just like zina between the people concerned and the rest of the community should not worry. The rapist is not looking for consent. And so the nature of the crime makes some scholars feel it suits more from what they call the tahqiq al-manat, you know, the looking carefully at the analogy, that the analogy with hiraba is more solid than the analogy between rape and zina. Of course, ultimately, it will be for the judiciary, the legislatures, those who are making laws, to consult with scholars, listen, but also get the various experts involved, so that whatever laws we are going to use for the definition of rape, and we've said there are different forms of rape under this category of sexual violence or sexual assault, it is for that category of people to decide what's the definition, what evidence is required. Because in the case of hiraba, all you need is evidence that convinces the judge. It could be forensics, whereas forensic will not be accepted in a case of zina. Photography, filming would not be accepted in a case of zina, because the punishment of zina, besides confession or cases of confession, to prove a case of zina, it has to be done publicly. That the punishment for zina is actually not just that zina took place. If that was enough, then two witnesses would have been adequate, and circumstantial evidence would have been adequate, just as it is adequate for more serious offenses like murder. But the severe punishment of zina, whether 100 lashes or stoning, when it is proven, is actually because the person brought it public. So whether by bringing it to a public figure like a judge, or the act was committed where public defined by a minimum of four decent people witness the crime with graphic details, and that there is no doubt about it. So when we look at the kind of evidence that zina would require, or which hiraba would require, it may be easier to prove a case, or it is easier actually to prove a case of hiraba than to prove a case of zina. However, again, this is an area of ijtihad. It's juristic reasoning that is causing the difference, and whether they do qiyas or reasoning by analogy, which is a secondary source of sharia, whether they do that reasoning with the case of hiraba in Quran chapter 5 verse 33, or whether they do it with the case of zina of Quran chapter 24 verse 2, or in the hadith on the punishment for zina of the married. When it comes to witnesses, therefore, as we've already mentioned, the kind of evidence required to prove zina is very, very difficult to get in the case of rape. It is very unfair for somebody who can be robbed of their property to bring circumstantial evidence, and that case can be listened to, but for a more serious offense of rape, to say that that circumstantial evidence will not be necessary, and the person or perpetrator goes free and is innocent until proven guilty, and the proof is something that is nearly impossible to present. What that usually does is it then makes the woman a suspect for just defaming the perpetrator. Many women don't give testimony for rape in court for various reasons. Some fear they will be judged and viewed as immoral. What were you doing in his house? What were you doing in the classroom? Why were you dressed in this way? And so even though the offense is an offense of such gravity, because of her own guilt of either having done something wrong, even if her wrong was nothing compared to that of the perpetrator, she keeps quiet. Sometimes she raises the point, but is blamed for her dressing, blamed for, but why did you go there? But why did you trust him? But why did you this and that? Sometimes it is domestic, where she is not even expected to dress in hijab, and it's a case of incest by an uncle, a stepfather, or someone quite close. The fear of repercussions. Sometimes family members tell the rape victim, keep quiet about it, or you cannot stand before the law, or you can't afford to take it to court, or you don't have enough testimony or witnesses. Sometimes there's the threat by the perpetrator that this person is so respected in the community, your word against their word, nobody would listen to you, and the woman, or sometimes even the family, just decide to keep quiet about it. Sometimes, and this is very common and on the increase, the person who was raped didn't even know they were raped. They were drugged and raped, and or they were intoxicated one way or the other, and they were raped. And it is later they got the signs or got to realize they were raped. And so they didn't have any opportunity to shout, to call for help. Sometimes when a university lecturer rapes a student in his office, she agrees to it. But why? Because he made it clear she wouldn't graduate until she accepted. That is not consensual, that is forcing her. Sometimes it is blackmail. And as I said before, rape is not just male and female. I'm saying that just because that's the common example of a man raping a woman, but we have it the other way around. We have women raping women, we have men raping men. And we have adults raping children of various ages, from pedophilia and others. Sometimes the rape took place in a place that was so desolate, so quiet. Sometimes the threat of death, of repercussions, various reasons. Sometimes the person just doesn't trust that if they speak, anything will happen because they know what happened before. And so what happens, unfortunately, is the rape victim ends up becoming somebody who can be raped again and again and again with no consequences. From a number of studies on university campuses, they found up to 1.7%. This is studies in Nigeria. And you can check this on Google, look for the websites that have studied this. Up to 1.7% of people have been involved in perpetuating rape. Up to 2.5% of men and up to 1.1% of women have actually perpetrated rape against somebody else. When it comes to the problem of rape, we also have the case where, as we've mentioned before, most of these cases are not reported. Unfortunately, in some cultures, and this is actually in some northern Nigerian cultures, and I'm just mentioning it just because of how serious it is, and I'm not specifying because I'm sure it's not restricted to just one culture, is the belief that if a man has sexual intercourse with an insane woman, a lunatic, a woman who is mentally derailed, that that is something that increases the omen or chances that he will become rich in the future. And so they find that among mild and moderate intellectual disabled women, in other words, women who have some intellectual disabilities, up to 68% of them have been raped. And so it's not surprising you find women who are insane on the streets, but who have actually been raped. Unfortunately, we have very limited rape testing kits in our hospitals. Nobody is able to do the DNA testing. You have to go to some very expensive place. For most people who have been raped, it's difficult to have that evidence. And of course, even where it comes up, many would claim that no, it was consensual, especially because overwhelming majority, up to 90% of those who are involved in rape are known to the person. And as we said, only about 5% of cases in Nigeria are reported. And of those that are reported, a total of the cases that are reported, only 5% are reported. But of that five, only 3.5% actually get any meaningful assistance. And so you actually find that about just over 96% of cases of rape get any action taken. In many studies, up to, even in the United States, among universities, up to 20%, one in five cases of rape take place against women between their entrance into university and their graduation from university. So this is a very serious underground problem. And I think the need for us to really look at the kind of demands we make. Some Muslims say a woman's testimony is half that of a man's in Islamic law. This is a misrepresentation of Islamic law. In the area of witnesses, there are certain cases where the woman's testimony is stronger in Islamic law than that of a man's. So in cases to do with fostering of children, who suckled which child, in issues that relate to the menstrual period or something that women would know best, in areas where during pregnancy there's a debate among the midwives or with others regarding which child belonged to which mother, the woman's testimony is stronger than that of a man's testimony in all the major schools of Islamic law. So you have cases where women are more competent than men, where the woman's testimony is stronger than the man's testimony. You have cases where the woman's testimony is the same as the man's testimony. And this is in most cases. Hadith is our second source of information about Islam after the Quran. That's where we learn most of the sunnah of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, from. But when it comes to how many testimonies do we need to accept that a hadith is authentic from the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, one woman's hadith is enough, so long as she is credible, just as one man's hadith is enough or narration is enough, so long as that person is credible. So we have many cases where the man's testimony is the same as that of a woman's. In fact, when it comes to a woman's testimony, we have the hadith where a woman told a man, he was married to a woman, the man just got married, but this lady, it actually says she was a black lady. She came and told the man, I fostered, I suckled you, and I suckled your wife. And in Islamic law, they become foster brothers and sisters between whom marriage is not allowed. So the Prophet went with the lady to, this companion went to the lady, to the Prophet, to report his case. That this woman says she suckled me and she suckled my wife. And the Prophet then asked a rhetorical question. Then what else is there between you and your wife but divorce? In other words, this woman's testimony was enough to break this man's marriage, and her knowledge of the area was enough for her to stand as expert witness or the most competent in that subject area. So we do have cases where the woman's testimony is less than that of a man's if it's an area where the man's testimony is more competent. So in areas to do with violent crimes, which are usually perpetrated by men, most scholars would say in cases of qisas, that they would prefer a man's testimony and not a woman's testimony. But this is their own ijtihad. It's not based on verses of Quran. It's looking at culturally, these are areas men would know better than women, just as traditionally midwives and those involved in the whole subject of obstetrics and gynecology were traditionally women. A man going to a place where a woman was delivering, such a man would actually be considered a very irresponsible man. What are you doing there? Just the fact that he was there was usually enough to undermine his moral standing and integrity. In Islamic finance, in the area of the ayat ad-dayn in Surah Al-Baqarah, the verse that deals with debts, the Quran is discussing here loans for a period of time, and it says you should have two women or one man and two women, so that if one forgets, the other will remind. Now, different scholars have given various reasons of this ratio of one to two. Some scholars like Ibn Taymiyyah give more sociological reasons. Ibn Qayyim gives sociological reasons, looking at the context. But one thing to remember is the number of witnesses are wasail for justice. They are means of convincing the judge. If you don't have the required number of witnesses for a particular offense, other than the hudud, for hiraba, for this and that, the judge would look at whatever other circumstantial evidence, forensic evidence, whatever evidence will convince the judge. In fact, even if you bring in the case of hudud, four witnesses to zina, and the judge is not comfortable with the character of those witnesses, he can reject the witnesses. In other words, you can't force witnesses upon the judge if the judge is not comfortable with those witnesses. The job of witness is to protect justice. It is to convince the judge that truth is on your side and your evidence is more credible than the evidence for the opposite position. So when we look at the question of women's testimony, again, when it comes to the case of rape, it is up to the judge to decide whoever has been raped, what kind of evidence convinces the judge or the judges, depends on the court. Some of the Sharia courts have three judges listening to a case. So it is really what convinces the judge that should matter. And it doesn't there matter whether the person complaining about rape is a male or female, or even a child, if the judge can cross-examine and get other circumstantial evidence that convinces the judge beyond a shadow of doubt, or there may be doubt. But based on the level of doubt and the kind of circumstances when these crime of rape was done, the judge can decide whether to give a punishment as severe as death sentence or any of the other hirava punishments, or whether to give something as imprisonment for the offense. Unfortunately, because of this issue of not accepting the woman's testimony and other circumstantial evidence, we currently have women behind bars who have not been able to prove that their pregnancy was a case of rape and not one of zina. When, as we've mentioned, the case for hudud requires very clear evidence, and from the time of the Prophet ﷺ, pregnancy was not considered evidence of zina. In fact, when a woman came with pregnancy to Sayyidina Ali, Ali asked her, is it possible maybe you were raped? He was trying to find excuses to avoid dealing with her confession as a confession. And one of the examples he brought is, maybe you were raped. Maybe somebody slept with you while you were asleep and you didn't know how you got pregnant. And that kind of case was even brought to Umar, and he let it go. A case of a woman who said her pregnancy to Sayyidina Umar the Caliph was that she was lost in the desert and she was thirsty, and somebody said he would give her water only if she allowed him to rape her. And that is how she got her pregnancy. And it wasn't treated as a case of evidence or proof of zina. On the issue to do with marital rape, can rape happen in a marriage? Now, this is an area where nomenclature and what we call things make some people, take it off the table immediately and say that's an oxymoron. You can't be married to somebody, have the right to have sexual relations with this person, and describe the act of rape as being similar to a stranger or an unknown person coming and raping them. If, however, the offense of rape is treated not like sexual relations, but the offense of rape is treated like hiraba, as forced entry against your own will, and it's viewed as an act of violence, then violence can be prosecuted in Islamic law. In fact, even in classical Islamic law, if a man goes and sleeps with his wife and injures her in the process, it's an offense that is treated with like dia. In other words, in one case, he will have to pay up to 1/3 of the blood money for killing a person, and others differ in how much that compensation would be. But there's the recognition that just because it is sexual in nature doesn't mean it cannot be a criminal offense. And if we take the reasoning of someone like Ibn al-Arabi, if slapping your wife, if battering and abusing your wife can be considered a legal offense in Islamic law, then raping your wife could be considered an even greater form of abuse and a greater form of humiliation that the court definitely should be able to handle. This again calls for the need for more scholars and experts, counselors, those who deal with these cases, to share with scholars so as to be able to look at what would be the most appropriate legal reforms in order to ensure that under the cover of the anonymity and the various shadows in society, rapes and domestic violence and its various forms do not continue to be perpetrated. On the question of what happens if a rape victim finds she is pregnant, definitely the moment somebody is a rape victim, it needs to be clear that pregnancy is not proof of zina. And so we don't start with accusing the person of having done something wrong. If somebody is pregnant, we still continue to operate under the position of people are innocent until proven guilty, and proof of zina requires evidence where there is no doubt. As the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam said, you avoid the had, such as zina, with shubahat, if there's doubt, if there's uncertainty. And the fact that a person could be pregnant because of rape, because of some form of artificial insemination or in vitro fertilization, there are many other ways people can get pregnant without the actual act of sexual penetration in the traditional sense. And we've seen this in modern times. What to do about the unwanted pregnancy or the pregnancy from a rape victim? The scholars have given various positions here, both old and new. Scholars of the Hanafi school of thought take it that while the living embryo of a woman is a living thing from the time it is in her womb, in fact, even the cell, the sperm cell, is a living thing, but the moment it is fertilized, you actually now have an embryo. So there's no argument among the scholars that the embryo from day one of fertilization is a living thing. However, because of the hadith and statement of the Prophet, peace be upon him, that the soul is breathed into the embryo on the 120th day, in other words, exactly 4 months from conception, while they discourage abortion at any time, they consider it as only a clear haram after that 120th day, after the first 4 months. And because of that, many contemporary scholars, Uthaymeen, many contemporary scholars have found the Hanafi position the most appropriate for rape victims or any form of pregnancy that needs to be terminated, and they would consider it permissible for the pregnancy to be terminated before the 120th day, which is usually even when it is safer to prevent, to abort. Some among the Shafi'i schools look at 40 to 60 days, so difference of opinion there. When Imam bin Uthaymeen was asked about a case in Algeria where some women had been raped and what to do about it, one of his recommendations, apart from it being the choice of the woman, if the woman wants to carry on with the pregnancy, that's her choice. But she should not be made to feel guilty of aborting when she is the one who will carry the burden of it. So it's really her choice, and it is part of rahma, tawasul bis sabr wa tawasul bil marhama, for us to support her and counsel her and get experts, not to just take it as something where we make her feel guilty just because she says she would rather go with the opinion of abortion, if that is actually in the best interest of her and in the best interest of the child. So we should be more victim-centric, more concerned with the challenges she is going through, and use the difference of opinion among scholars as a source of rahmah, as scholars do in istihsan, what is called juristic preference, where they will take the opinion of a scholar as more appropriate than others, or some would look at what achieves the maqasid best, besides just the evidence for it, what solves the problem. On the subject, therefore, of pregnancy, while there are those scholars who say the moment there's a pregnancy, the only thing that would permit abortion is a threat to the life of the mother. We know there are many scholars who take it that there are many other reasons, severe deformities, health challenges, many other issues, including rape, that could come up where if the abortion is done before the 120 days, it is considered permissible. Imam Abu Hamid al-Ghazali probably summarized it by saying, abortion at any time is considered wrong. However, the wrong associated with it increases its gravity with the age of the fetus. But I would suggest that communities and scholars look more into the Hanafi opinion as one that gives a leeway, that gives a chance for women who have been raped to not live with the trauma and all the stigma and all the difficulties that come with an unwanted pregnancy, how it affects their education, how it affects their chances of getting married, work, and all those problems that are associated with it. Again, this requires more dialogue between those who are in the field, who see the challenges associated with these pregnancies. To conclude, and here I'd like to talk about ways of moving forward. I think there's the need for much greater enlightenment about the subject on rape, to recognize the amount of ijtihad and juristic reasoning that is involved when scholars speak on this topic, that this is not a topic of what is called qat'i thubut, qat'i dilala, of categorical certain statements that come from Quran or hadith of undisputed authenticity, whose meanings are clear and categorical. This is not God speaking, God saying this or that. This is where scholars differ on the kind of reasoning by analogy that is more appropriate to this offense. So it is an area of ijtihad. It is important for us to always appreciate the diversity of scholars, the way we appreciate the diversity of tools in a toolbox, that they give us options to look at what is more appropriate for our context. As my honorable father used to like saying, scholars are like trees that bear fruit. Some fruit are ripe and good for taking. Other fruit are raw, not yet ready, because the scholar is still learning and hearing more from the community in various areas. And some fruit are rotten. They were ripe a week ago. They belong to a particular context, but not appropriate for the current context. So look at what is more appropriate and don't insult the scholars. Speak respectfully of the scholars while at the same time looking at those aspects of Sharia that are part of the mutaghayyirat. These are statements in the Quran and the Sunnah and the verdicts of scholars that change with context. The scholars have a maxim they all agree on, which is la yunkar, there's no denying taghir al-hukum bi taghir al-zaman or taghir al-hukum bi taghir al-ahwal. There's no denying of the need to change rulings and change fatwas as context situations change. And so there's need for more enlightenment. There's the need for us to not confuse rahmah, compassion, and forgiveness and mercy with the need for justice when rape victims come. When a rape victim comes, they are in need of the greatest amount of compassion and justice. We stand for justice. It is if you are a victim of somebody else's abuse, you have the choice to stand for justice and ensure the perpetrator is dealt with by the law, or you forgive. But because you are the victim, you choose. The Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam is reported by one of his companions, Anas, as having said, excuse me, that the Prophet never retaliated against a wrong that was done to him personally. He was forgiving. However, and so even when somebody tried to poison him, he forgave the lady. When people treated him in very harsh manners in Makkah, he would forgive. However, if something wrong was done to somebody else, the Prophet would always stand for justice and never make the victim feel guilty that they had not forgiven. The reason is because justice is an understated but very important form of compassion. Justice is a way of ensuring that the offense is not repeated. Justice is compassion to the victim. Justice is compassion to future victims. So when somebody comes with a case of rape or any form of sexual assault or abuse, let us not start saying, well, Islam prefers compassion to justice, and then you make the person have to forgive or feel guilty that they have not forgiven. No. Your compassion is to the greater good of society. Your compassion should be with the victim and ensure justice to perpetrator. Why? Because every perpetrator is usually going to be a repeat offender. And most perpetrators are actually the repeat offenders. In criminology, they have what they call the 20-80 rule of crime, which is that 80% of criminal activity and law breaking is often by the same 20% of repeat offenders. 80% of car accidents are by the same 20% of rough drivers. 80% of rapists or rape cases are by the same repeat 20% of offenders. They are the ones who keep repeating, doing it again and again. And there's a lot of studies for this. People rape, they go to prison, they get released. When they are caught again, what was their offense? Rape again. And usually when they are caught and it is reported, that is when other victims actually get the courage to come and report, and you realize that the case you thought was a one-off case that you were contemplating forgiving is actually somebody who is a serial rapist and offender. So it is important that we increase enlightenment, scholars, lawyers, judges, the general public. Let us bring this topic to the fore. It is not the only problem. There are bigger problems in society, but this is the worst violent crime that is so underreported that many victims are suffering in silence. The other area that we need to look at is reform of our laws, leadership, and the law enforcement agencies, for us to consult with scholars again, but get more data of what's going on. Because unless these data, these surveys are conducted, we honestly don't know what's going on in society. One case happens, we behave as if the world has come to an end, when in reality, we have over 100 times what we are seeing taking place behind the scenes. So while we should be infuriated about what we have seen, we should actually be more infuriated because what we have seen, what we have not seen, is 20 times what we are seeing. We need more nurses, more counselors, more NGOs involved in counseling, involved in helping victims, involved in getting legal advice and counseling, the community to be more aware. Families. Families, because they often are interested in protecting the dignity of the family, this protecting the honor of the individual rapist concern, they end up becoming the biggest perpetrators of injustice instead of showing compassion. One of the objectives of family life in the Quran is for the purpose of mawadda and sakina, of rahma, of an environment of tranquility, of peace, a safe space for children to grow, for people to be humans, not a hellhole, not a prison where people are trapped in various forms of repeated suffering. So let us not displace our responsibility. As parents, the first priority is the victim, and we should deal ruthlessly with any family member, because if you keep quiet, we need to distinguish between being against rape and actively being anti-rape, and somebody who is not involved in it, but keeps quiet, and you just are a standby. Because Shaitan likes people who are standby. Because you know about the case, when a girl brings a complaint that she has been raped, and you ask her, who else knows about it? I told this person, I told this person, I told this person, and they have not done anything. That weakens you. It makes it more difficult for you to do something when you know other respected people also know about it, but they haven't done something. In other words, those bystanders who didn't do anything actually become like the supporters club of Shaitan. They become the ones who, without doing anything, discourage others from taking action. Whereas somebody would have taken action and would be outraged at this particular case. So the need for family members to remember, parents, your number one duty is to your children and to Allah. They are the ones who you have been chosen as the families that will raise these children. And you will answer to Allah on how you handle this case. As individuals, one thing that is very important is the courage to speak up. So long as this offense stays underground, stays undercover, that only 5% of cases are reported, it will be very difficult for society to do anything. And so this is where the Quran encourages us, ta'awanu alal birr wa taqwa, you know, collaborate in the doing of good deeds, of pious actions, that when you find somebody who is a victim, see how to cooperate with the person and deal with it, bring it out for justice to take its course. But of course, learn from the mistakes of others. Learn from what didn't work and try new ways of ensuring that we increase the number of reportage and reported cases. Of course, as individuals, we should take precautions. As individuals, we should not put ourselves in compromising situations. We need to be really careful about the friends we keep, where we go, what time we go to places. Over 30%, actually it's about 35-37%, depends on the society, of rape cases are by somebody who was on what they call a date rape. It was somebody who was trusted, was assumed to never consider that. So a lot, as we've said, nearly 90% of rape cases are actually carried out by somebody known to the rapist. So the need to take precautions on how we conduct ourselves, how we behave, not to go to places where even angels wouldn't go. Careful about going to places where people take drugs, people drink, people who unfortunately have no good intention. So look at all the factors that could compound or be steps in that direction. But to conclude, the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam said, "Man ra'a minkum munkaran," whoever sees something wrong, let him change it with his hand, with the authority. Like, do the best you can to prohibit and stop wrongdoing. But if you can't, then stop it with your tongue. Speak about it. And I congratulate Micah on creating the opportunity for us to speak on this issue. But then the Prophet said, but if you can't even do that, then aspire, change it with your heart. Aspire for change. Pray for it to change. But then he said, he qualified, if you could have done better, but you didn't do with your hand, you didn't do with your tongue, and you decided it is with your heart, the Prophet said, "Zalika ad'aful iman." That is the weakest level of faith. Your batteries of taqwa are so weak that you can't do any action beyond just hoping things will change. I hope that what I have said has been of some use to us, that this will stimulate more thinking, better understanding of the position of Islam, the avenue for more thinking, the need for more legal reform, and that we take it upon ourselves to push in whatever capacity we can towards preventing this problem and dealing with perpetrators, and at least reducing, even if we can't eliminate, reduces the problems of rape in our society. I pray you forgive me and Allah forgive me where I've made mistakes. May Allah continue to guide us aright. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi ta'ala wa barakatuhu. And thank you very much. Wassalamu alaikum. Abdul Rashid, Micah, you can wake up if you are sleeping. Okay, if I don't hear anything, I would like to request any of the Micah members.
Good. Jazakallah khairan for the very refreshing lecture, very empowering. So I picked a few words, victim-centric, and we need to show more compassion to the victim and show support. I've seen a lot of chats. I think what you've done basically is that you've actually answered a lot of the questions that are bothering people's minds in your lecture. I thank you for that. I pray Allah will continue to honor you and elevate you and also illuminate your path. I don't know if you have any parting shots or parting words for us before we do the dua.
All I would say is just from the little reading that I have done on this topic, this is a very serious problem for the victims. It's very crippling. You know the way somebody has a back pain and it makes it difficult for them to sit for some time. Somebody has a broken leg. Rape is a psyche-breaking act, and it traumatizes people for a very long time. And unfortunately, because it's not visible, we don't see it. And unless the victim opens up, you don't know how many victims are actually around you. Again, in this COVID times, rape comes like this pandemic. It is everywhere. The statistics are very, very disturbing. Of course, some societies are worse than others. And in cultures where you have a lot of big families, there's a tendency to not embarrass family members, the name of the family. I honestly think we should really be careful about this subject area in view of the verse of the Quran where Allah tells us to stand for justice, even if it's against your parents, even if it's against your family members. Our relationship with Allah is what matters most. And we should not let relationships come in the way of our standing for justice, especially for loved ones. So I just pray that, I don't like to use the word, let's make more noise about this subject, but for those who are making noise, unfortunately in a democracy, unless you make a big deal, many of our leaders are like flags waiting for the wind to blow before they rise, waiting for the wind to blow before they do anything. And unless we blow the wind, the leaders don't rise. Unless we become wind blowers, unless we are actively making it clear enough is enough, it doesn't matter whether the cases are lesser than other problems we have in society, this is a case, and whoever is the victim, as Muslims, anywhere we see something wrong, we do our best to stop it through all the means available at our disposal. So I would like to encourage, there's a lot on Wikipedia, there's a lot on Muslim websites, there's a lot on UN and so many, this information has been studied by a lot. Among the TED videos, TED, not just TEDx, but that's one of them. But there's some very useful, very interesting, heart-wrenching cases that I think we should be more exposed to as we try to grapple with this challenge, its contemporary manifestations, and how our Muslim scholars try and give the necessary support to better legislation that is accepted within the community and has teeth it can be implemented, and not just something that is just good on paper, but you know, where we are not able to build trust within the community. Wallahu alam, that's all I would say. And thank you very much for the opportunity. My apologies again for any mistakes on my part. I pray Allah forgives me and that you forgive me there too. Jazakumullahu khairan. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi ta'ala wa barakatuh. Over and out.
Micah. Okay. Yeah. I don't know if anyone has any. Do we still have time to get contributions, or I don't know if you mind anyone to talk, or we just end the section that way?
I'm okay. Up to you.
Well,
yeah, so if there are any questions, again, show of hands so that we can have the person speak. But before anybody speaks, inshallah, we'll be sharing the recording. We'll edit and share it with everybody. That's one. Then this conversation is an ongoing conversation. I'm reminded of a saying that if you think you are too small to make a change or make a difference, try sleeping in a room with a mosquito. So we all owe it a duty to ourselves, to our sisters, especially when you read through the charts, there's an impression that the men have decided to keep quiet. It's not even about man versus woman, it's about humanity. It's a despicable act, and it should be condemned. Nobody, no rights thinking person should be doing that to another person, because it breaks the individual. I don't know if there's any questions, but I know Rudin has accepted to.
A couple of questions and hands raised.
Read the questions.
Okay, I think the speaker might unmute themselves to ask or so. So, Amusa Amina, your hands are raised. Would you like to ask a question? You can unmute your mic. Okay, Olayinka Abdulkabir.
I think some are putting their hands up on the screen, not yes, raising their hands with the reaction button. I think you may need to
Trying to call them. So, Abdul Martins.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, the Mica team, and I say jazakumullah khairan to Sheikh Nuruddin. Barakallahu fiikum. I actually wanted to get some clarifications as far as the issue of marital rape is concerned. And personally, myself, have been making some little bit of readings, and maybe I'm a little bit stuck. Let me say there are some things that I just quite want to seek clarifications upon. For example, when we go by the modernist definition of what marital rape is, it can go to the very level of even when a woman or a man that are legally married, and then they have started, maybe they want to initiate a sexual intercourse process or something, and then they have started. And then maybe the man is about to penetrate, and then the woman says, no, of course, I'm not interested again. To them, if the man still, you know, continues to still have that intercourse with her, that might also mean, you know, the type of rape, according to them. So at the same time, from many of what you have said, and from what have been available as sources of Islamic readings also, is that you said when injury is seen, like bruises on the woman that is married, and then she's accusing the husband of raping her, of course, the judge can decide to punish him. What of an institution where, you know, no injuries are seen, and then, of course, and then the woman is still saying that he raped me, and then there are no injuries? That's the second thing. And then the third thing is that if rape is an act of zina, which is the aslu, is that rape is zina. So, does it mean that even when a man is legally married to a woman, raping the wife now, or let me see, are we still using the same word, rape, for that particular process, or we'll use another word entirely? Because we cannot actually say that he has performed zina with the wife. That is one of the things that I wanted to ask. Jazakumullah khairan wa barakallahu fi.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Let me, if you don't mind, Rashid, I comment on those ones first.
Yes, please. Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. Number one, a comment on the comment that this is an area where only women seem to be making the noise. It is very true. If you look at any offense, it is usually the victim that speaks loudest because they know where it pinches the most. However, the Quran describes men and women as awliya of each other in enjoining right and forbidding wrong, as protecting friends and helpers of each other. So while the victims may be mainly women, the responsibility of doing something about it is shared by all people of conscience and iman, irrespective of gender. On the question of marital rape, number one, if you recall in the beginning, I said, this is a subject where part of the problem is the nomenclature. We do not have a separate word for it. And the question is, then how do we categorize that offense? Of course, it is difficult to say somebody did zina, which is part of the problem of with his wife, which is part of the problem of saying rape is a form of zina. And then you want to say, and somebody did zina with his wife. Zina by definition is extramarital. So it would be viewed as an oxymoron. However, what you find in Islamic jurisprudence and in the qawaid, Islamic legal maxims or Islamic legal philosophy, they would say, al-ibra lil-maqasid wal-ma'ani, la lil-alfad wal-mabani, that consideration is given to the objectives of things and their inner meaning, not to alfad, not to the words and phrases that we use. Which is why I would rather, instead of using a word that is already loaded in meaning, like rape, and bring that into marriage, what would be a description where we all know what we are talking about? For example, forced sexual intercourse of a man towards his wife, in other words, within the marital context. Is that in line with the Sunnah or is it against the Sunnah? I think any thinking Muslim would know that any form of sexual relations where the husband is not comfortable or the wife is not comfortable, and somebody says, I'm still going to go ahead with it, whether you like it or not, this is not the Sunnah of Islam. This is not the example of the Prophet. It's supposed to be love making. It's supposed to be something where there's even reward in it. But what we find in the maxims of Islamic jurisprudence is la darar wa la dirar, the Prophet said. You know, a darar yuzal. The Prophet said, you should not cause harm nor reciprocate harm. So if just before whatever foreplay you would have done or not done, when it comes to the point of sexual penetration and the wife says no, then it is part of the respect you have for your wife to be sensitive to her needs. She may be sick. She may not feel like it. It's supposed to be something that builds love, not builds resentment and anger. So number one, if the Prophet said, la darar wa la dirar, then it is important for us to say, is this harm? If it is harm, then it must be eliminated, whatever name people try to use for it. And of course, we look at the maqasid of marriage, of mawadda, of love, of rahmah, of sakina, of tranquility, compassion, where the Quran describes wives and husbands as, you know, antum libasun lahunna, that you are garments for them, protecting them, their honor, their dignity, their safety and security. Wahunna libasun lakum, and they are like garments for you. Is a man going ahead with sex, with his wife, when she's against it, is that in any way in line with the statements of the Prophet, the statements of the Quran related to husband and wife relationship? I think it is absolutely no. And so I wouldn't describe a man who decides when his wife says no, or a man who says to his wife, please no, In other words, there's a justifiable, understandable reason that any sensible person would appreciate. I don't look at that as a modernist thing. I look at that as a humane expression of respect and self-restraint, of sabr, of rahma towards the other person's feelings. So the other thing, when I was saying about a judge for domestic violence, injuries and all of this type of thing, what we find in the hadith is number of women coming to the Prophet ﷺ complaining about the abuse. One said, even my husband beat me. And the Prophet said, go back and beat him too. Until a revelation came that moderated that. But the Prophet didn't start asking for witnesses. Let me see your injury. No. Why? Because there are certain types of cases where people would not come to normally report unless it was true. A woman wouldn't bring her case to court unless it is something she has had enough of. A person doesn't come and with all the threat to her safety, to issues to do with stigmatization, come and say, I was raped by this person. And you want to say, you are guilty until proven innocent. It's a lie. No, but this is again not a decision for you and me. This is for a competent judge. And this calls for the need for better training of our judges in the way they cross-examine various types of cases. Because for something like a rape case, okay. Can you hear me now? Okay, yeah. Alaikum salam. Alhamdulillah. All right. So the last point I said about the question of even in a case where sexual assault or abuse has taken place within marriage, it is really up to the judge and the qualified competent to decide what kind of evidence constitutes what would satisfy the judge. So it's really going to be a very case-by-case basis. And what would be the compensation? You know, what would be the penalty in that type of case? But I think that case is easier if we remove loaded terminology. This is Western, this is this. Let's look at it from action. The statement that if there's a case of rape, the asal is that it is zina. In other words, the premise is that rape is a case of zina. This is not an asal established from the Quran or the Sunnah. This asal is actually established by scholars who prefer to interpret it as zina, whereas others prefer to interpret it as hiraba. So just on that issue of what's the default, do we start with the assumption that this is a case of zina, or do we start with the assumption that this is the case of hiraba? I think number one, it's all agreed. We are starting with somebody who is the victim of abuse, and what we need is evidence of that abuse and the most competent people to decide what to do about it, who are, of course, the legal authorities. But then, of course, there are other non-legal things that can be done to prevent or to censure in cases where the legal is insufficient. Wallahu alam. Second question, if you don't mind. Micah, over and out.
Okay, so I'm trying to...
Okay, no, don't worry. I'm on mute. Who do you want to meet next? I think we should mention the person's name, so in case you can't know that.
Miriam Ogunlade, are you still willing to talk?
Okay, somebody asked a question in the chat about what is the age of consent in Islam. Is there one? This is an area that some scholars have differed when it comes to consent for marriage. Um, Let me start by saying, when it comes to marriage, the default position has been there hasn't been agreement. Sexual relationship before sexual relations. When it comes to, when it came to the subject of the marriage of Fatima, the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam's daughter, she married Ali when she was probably around 18 or 19 years old. The age at which a person gets married has usually been determined by the family. Just like what age before you climb a horse is determined by family, not government. You know, now we have government deciding you need to reach the age of 18 before you ride a motorcycle or before you drive a car and get a driving license. You need to reach this age before this and that age. So different purposes have different ages. So in some of the more Western laws, you have age of consent, depending on the country, as being from the age of 14. In some countries it is 16, some it's 15, some it's 18, and some it's, I think Fiji has a higher age of consent. Of can an Islamic some age for marriage, if the Prophet peace be upon him and the Sahaba not put a minimum age for marriage. And the Quran, of course, did not, for being a soldier, for rider, a pilot into your 60s and 70s. You can't be a surgeon beyond certain ages. So different professions have minimum, maximum ages by which you should retire. And when you ask, why do these minimum or maximum ages exist? Scholars say it is maslaha, public interest. Because public interest, or the common good, is one of the sources of Sharia. So if you look at what they call the sources of Sharia, where does Islamic law come from? It comes from the Quran, it comes from the Sunnah, but sometimes when the Sunnah and the Quran are silent on issues, scholars look elsewhere for guidance. They look at whether there's a consensus among scholars. They look at reasoning by analogy. They look at urf, which is custom. Is it in line with the local custom? Is the custom against or in favor of this? They would look at maslaha, public interest, public good. They would look at ra'ayi or fatwa of sahaba. What was the opinion of a companion of the Prophet that was not opposed by another opinion? They would look at istishab, the presumption of the continuity, the status quo, which is how have we been doing things as a source of guidance in producing fatwas. They would look at saduzaria, a preclusion, blocking things that would lead to harm. They would look at istihsan, equity. They would look at these maqasid. What are the objectives of Sharia? And what new rules do we bring under the rubric of istihsan to develop laws to continue to adapt to changing circumstances. Quran and Sunnah did not put a limit whether you wanted to drive on the right or the left-hand side of the road. It was open, it was up to your own custom and culture which one you preferred. However, a time comes where we realize we can't allow people to be defecating anywhere. The Quran and Sunnah did not say you cannot go into any bush. The Quran and Sunnah did not say you can't take your rubbish from home and just dump it outside. And scholars, why? Because the jurists are treated as warathatul anbiya, those who are the inheritors of the roles of prophets. These are the people who will look at what the prophet left behind and come up with new laws that would be more appropriate for our context. So there are a lot of traffic rules that didn't exist during the time of horses and camels and chariots. There are a lot of rules on environment. There are a lot of rules on marriage. And so on marital issues, in the past, if you said to your wife, I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you, the prophet treated it as one divorce. Sometimes you said it is just a repetition of what this was creating problems, and it seemed to be allowing a lot of the abuse of divorce. He instituted a law that three divorces on one occasion would now be equal to three, and it was final. This is Umar bin Khattab using what is called Sadduzariya, making prohibited something that was permissible. In other words, now it is haram, even if it was tolerated before. So you have Sadduzariya as a source of law in Sharia, where we are allowed to make more laws that restrict things that were unrestricted in the past. So just as a community can agree to fix laws that restrict the age of driving, of holding a weapon, of holding political offices, many Muslim communities and scholars have restricted the age at which people get married, some to 14, some to 15, 16, 18, they look at their own public interest. Many look at the education as being compulsory, especially in communities where knowledge is a fardu kifaya. It is a, it's a, you know, we need doctors, we need nurses. We don't have enough, so we are in a situation of fardu ayn. It's an individual. These roles and professions are taken care of, required to perform a fardu kifaya, law enforcement, etc. Well, is itself a fardu kifaya. And so the scholars say, my life prerequisite for the realization of the fulfillment of something that is wajib is treated as wajib. So if this education is considered wajib, the age at which a person gets married is not wajib. From the Sharia point of view, traditionally, whether you marry at the age of 13 or 15 or 17 or 20 or 40, it's all mubah, it's all permissible. Of course, it is encouraged for you to marry younger. However, the how young is usually left to urf. If, however, it is that is to custom and tradition and, you know, families decide. If, however, a community realizes that leaving it open is undermining the education and the professions and the common good of society, then they can use the rules in Usulul Fiqh of Islamic jurisprudence of Sadduzariya, of blocking means to haram, even though those were originally halal. Some do it under istihsan, like in the Hanafi school, some do it as maslaha, but various tools for coming up with more laws that are more appropriate to our context, where certain types of education have become compulsory or universal as a right to all citizens and as a greater right than the right to get married, which can always be delayed, and which is better for the common community and the individual when it's delayed. Of course, there are exceptions to general rules. So that's what I would say on the question of the age of consent. Really, it has to be age of consent for what? And what would the community decide based on their situation would be the most appropriate age? Say, for example, when leaving behind orphans, at what to the orphan child? Depends. Half a billion naira, 518, give everything to him. Usability. What the Quran describes as an is intellectually capable of making responsible decisions on these issues. So the age at which you will give an orphan child 500 million or a billion would be different from 100 million, maybe different from 10 million, maybe different from 10,000. So it is up to the legal infrastructure to come up with what is in the best interest of realizing the maqasid or the objectives of Sharia in their context that keep changing. And so the laws would have to change to continue to be relevant for their purposes. Wallahu alam.
Jazakumullah khairan, brother Nur. It's 2 o'clock. We do want to hold you any longer, but jazakumullah khairan for your deep thoughts and for being very intentional about your delivery. We pray that Allah will continue to honor you and illuminate your path, and we pray that Allah will preserve you and yours, not just you, your family, and the entire Limu clan. And you are indeed a pride to the Deen. For all of us, even if you've not been unmuted, let's recite. Please let's together recite Surat Al-Kawthar for Brother Nuruddin. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Inna atayna kal-kawthar fasalli li rabbika wa la yashanaka wa akka. Jazakumullahu khairan. Thank you so much. Except if you want to give us closing dua. Give us a dua to Brother Nuruddin.
I think Iran, Alhamdulillah, Rabbil Alameen, Allahumma rizikuna ilman nafi'an, wa yakinan sadikan, wa dinan qayyima, wa nas'aluka dawaman najati min kulli bali'in, wa nas'aluka dawaman al-afiyah, wa nas'aluka tamam al-afiyah, wa nas'aluka shukur ala al-afiyah, wa nas'aluka al-gina ala al-nas, ya Rabbil Alameen. May Allah use us as instruments of good, wish good, for us to bring an end to the challenges that we face in our communities, and all of them, including rape. May God continue to strengthen those who are going through difficulties. May God continue to strengthen us, to strengthen them, and may He protect us all from harm. Subhan rabbika rabbil izzati amma yasifun, wa salamun ala al-mursalin.
Jazakumullah khairan.
Very much.
Thank you so much for your time. For the viewers, please join us on Sunday and also register. Look out for our social media handles to register. We'll be having a session on Success Through Emotional Intelligence series, which will be anchored by Sister Abiba Balogun. I think emotional intelligence is one of the important ingredients we need at this time as Muslims. Jazakumullah khairan, brother Nuruddin. So, I bid you farewell. Thank you so much for your time.